From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is on the hot seat again, criticized for an initially callous response to a mining disaster that killed more than 200 coal miners in western Turkey. The UN envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, resigned after failing to broker a political solution to the Syrian civil war. The U.S. and other supporters of the Syrian opposition met in London, but announced no specific new measures to bolster those forces against the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In Vienna, Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany began drafting a comprehensive nuclear agreement. Gaps have narrowed on several key issues, but remain over the scope of Iran's uranium enrichment program, the duration of proposed limitations on that program, and sanctions relief. And finally, yet another dire report about climate change. A study by researchers at NASA and the University of California says that a section of the West Antarctic ice sheet is melting, and it is too late to stop significant increases in sea levels, which could threaten coastal communities around the world. Abdurrahim, let's start with Turkey. Official death toll is already up almost to 300. It could be several hundred more. It's a mine in Soma that was privatized some years ago and passed over to a company that, at least according to the reports I'm reading, did not do a very good job in terms of maintaining safety standards. Erdogan's response was a little strange. Why do you think he responded that way, and what do you think the fallout's going to be?
Well, he's obviously extremely worried about his power, although he and his party did surprisingly well in the elections a few weeks ago.
The local ones, yeah.
The local ones. But remember that almost a year ago, there were huge demonstrations against him, and then now this issue of the mine and safety, and whether he and his party had deliberately blocked legislation which would have looked at the issue of safety in various enterprises throughout Turkey. He is obviously popular. He continues to be popular. Turks, for some reason, seem to like these grand projects that, you know, he has going up and down the country. But clearly, with the level of anger and resentment over what's happened now, he obviously has a lot to worry about, although he's gunning for the presidency in a few months' time, and Syria is not working for him. Lots of challenges now, both externally and internally for him.
Yeah. Tom, when he went to this area supposedly to console the relatives of those whose sons and brothers and fathers and husbands had been killed, he listed the high casualty rates and accidents in the late 19th and early 20th century in the United States, United Kingdom, France, and Japan. And, you know, he said, these are ordinary developments. Let's not pretend that such incidents do not occur in mines. This is part of the nature of the business. But the incidents he cited were all 100 years ago or more. So what, I mean, is he saying that it's adequate for Turkey to have the industrial safety standards of the West 100 years ago?
I think what he's demonstrating is that he's colossally tone deaf. I mean, it's hard to imagine, say, Ronald Reagan giving a speech after the 1983 horrible Beirut terror bombing where over 240 Marines and sailors lost their lives. It's hard to imagine, say, Ronald Reagan saying, stuff happens. This is kind of it's kind of the price you pay to be a superpower. So I think while he's popular and he's likely to win the presidency election in August, I think he and his advisors have got to be worried that they look a little callous. And also, there have been several reports that he and his party have really looked the other way when anyone has tried to take a serious legislative look at mine safety standards in Turkey. And the allegation of his critics is that he is in bed with the bad guys here, so to speak.
Sure, and as we know, there have been corruption charges leveled against members of his cabinet, even against his son. This was all sort of in the run-up to those local elections that you mentioned, Abdurrahim. But I was talking to a Turkish journalist the other day who tried to explain to me the mentality of the man and of his supporters. I've only met one other person, frankly, like Erdogan in my life, and that was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, who would never admit making a mistake, never show any weakness. And the view, at least expressed to me by this Turkish journalist, is that this group of people who support the AKP party, this Islamist-tinged party, were suppressed for so long by the secular state in Turkey that when they finally came to power, this was sort of their chance, and they are terrified to admit that they have made any mistakes because they feel that somehow that would show weakness and would embolden the secular forces, the military, others who, in their view, are just, you know, gnashing at the bit, waiting to get back at them. And of course, we also have the wrinkle of this Gulen movement, which was supportive of the AK party and now is not. So it's a kind of paranoid mentality in part, but it's also a legitimate fear, at least as expressed by this Turkish journalist, of showing weakness to the other side, which they fear is still very potent.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, let's give credit where credit is due. There's also debit. His credit is that he has built up the Turkish economy. Turkish economy has been growing for a decade now. A lot of Turks are proud of their economic achievements. And then there's the political stability that he has brought to the country after decades of military rule.
Relative stability.
relative stability. Military rule either directly or indirectly. But you're right to say relative stability because it's overstretched, because his feeling is that he's done so much. Now he feels that he also deserves so much. And part of what he feels he deserves is that he deserves more credit than anything else for all the things that he feels that he has done for his country. But clearly there are a lot of Turks, as your journalist friend clearly demonstrates, who do not feel the way Erdogan feels. First of all, economically, they feel that Turkey, yes, there has been growth, but there's been a lot of debt, external debt. It has grown. They feel that he is also miscalculated externally in terms of the so-called Arab Spring.
Right.
Remember,
Turkey
went from a time when he or his foreign minister did not tire of saying, we do not have problems with any of our neighbors, to a time now where they have problems with almost all their neighbors. Their miscalculations in Syria, their miscalculations in Egypt, and given the coup against the Islamist president of Egypt, that also seems to be somewhat echoing in Turkey among the liberals and secularists who feel that Erdogan is trying to Islamize or has Islamized the Turkish state.
We're going to turn now, Tom, to talk about Syria. There have been some developments in the past few days that do not suggest that we're getting any closer to political solution, an end to this horrible conflict. Lakhdar Brahimi, Algerian distinguished senior statesman, helped broker the end to the Taliban government and replacement of the Taliban government with a new Afghan government back more than a decade ago. 80 years old, was appointed to try to bring the various sides together and end the Syria war, and he resigned this week. Not a surprise, right?
Not a surprise. A resignation born, I think, out of enormous frustration that nothing is going right, that the agreement previously reached about Syria giving up its weapons of mass destruction is the implementation of that is proceeding very slowly. There are still fresh reports that chemical weapons have been used against opponents of the Assad regime. I think a coherent policy is going nowhere in Syria, and I thought it was also interesting that the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Army General Martin Dempsey, was talking about this the other day, and he basically said, without using this phrase, that the Syrian opposition is not in the major leagues. And what he meant by that is that even if the opposition could get its act together and win, which I think is very, very unlikely, that they have no capacity for for governance. Mm-hmm. They can't even get their act together internally with all the different factions. And so you had this spectacle of their leader coming to Washington, pleading for more weapons, especially surface-to-air, shoulder-fired missiles that can knock down Assad's helicopters and gunships, and getting politely turned down by President Obama. So it's hard to see how this improves at all in Syria anytime soon, and it's hard to see how 2 years after President Obama said that President Assad's days were numbered, he's still in control.
Very much so. Abdurrahim, there was a meeting in London of the so-called London 11. This is the group of countries that support the quote-unquote moderate opposition. And Secretary of State John Kerry was there. He referred to allegations which were made actually earlier in the week in Washington by the French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, that chemical weapons of a sort of different sort, chlorine gas, had been used by the Assad government. I was at a press breakfast where he said it had been used 11 times, then later on he said 14 times. John Kerry said that there was raw data suggesting that chlorine gas had been used by the Syrian government and that there would be consequences. What do you think the consequences would be? I looked at the communique that came out of that London 11 meeting, and there didn't seem to be a hell of a lot that was new in it. There was a discussion of, you know, they would decide on new measures at some future date.
Well, I mean, first of all, on the London meeting as such, there are a lot of people who were looking at it, especially people who have grown totally cynical about what the friends of Syria have been doing over the last 2 years or so. And they're saying that it's pitiful that the Friends of Syria group, in this particular meeting at least, went from over 70 countries to about 11 represented in the London meeting. The timing is interesting. No matter how you see the meeting of this group in London, Bashar al-Assad has officially announced his candidacy for yet another presidential term in Syria. And I think one of the bigger noises, so to speak, that came out of this meeting in London is that they're saying that the Friends of Syria will not recognize the candidacy of Bashar al-Assad. Whether they can do anything about it to stop it or delay it or cancel it, obviously the answer we know is they cannot. The issue of consequences, it's somewhat reminiscent of the issue of the red line.
The famous red line that President Obama had painted.
And then erased. It's hard to see what those consequences could be, given the fact that what we're hearing from Dempsey, what we're hearing from the White House, what we're hearing from almost every quarter of this administration, that military action in one way or another, whether in terms of giving the moderate Syrian opposition advanced weaponry or in some other form, is not on the cards for this administration. Yeah. Sanctions, they have been trying sanctions for so long. But I think that Syria is obviously caught up in the grand plan that Obama has for talks with the Iranians,
which we will get to in a minute. Let me stop you there, if I may. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of AllMonitor.com. Joining me today are Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Before we get to the Iranian talks, Tom, at this press breakfast with Laurent Fabius, the French foreign minister, he was actually pressed on the question of whether there might be military strikes by the United States or other countries against production facilities for chemical weapons in Syria. Under the agreement that was reached, that was brokered by the Russians last year, the Syrians agreed to send out their chemical weapons and the components for the chemical weapons, and also to destroy the production facilities, and they haven't done so. And he waffled, and then he said, well, there are no plans for a military strike. So overall, the impression one gets is that, you know, even though there are hints that there might be some of these so-called man pads passed to the opposition by a friendly regional government and or some efforts to improve humanitarian access to the country, you don't get an impression that there's really going to be a strong push against Assad in support of the opposition.
I couldn't agree with you more, Barbara. I think that's absolutely the case. There is no stomach whatsoever within the Obama administration for anything that a reasonable person would describe as robust action. against the Syrians. And I will say parenthetically, on a domestic political sidelight, I know many of our listeners know that the Republicans have been trying to figure out a way to get at former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who's probably going to run for president in 2016. And for the moment, at least, they have settled on the Benghazi tragedy. I suspect when all is said and done, Hillary Clinton's theoretically biggest political problem will be who lost Syria. And It's interesting, in the last several days, she has made a couple of speeches in which she has included a vigorous defense of the administration's actions in Syria. The way things are going in Syria, I think that's going to be a hard sell in a couple of years.
Yeah. Abdulhamid, you were talking about the larger context for this. And before we get to the Iran talks, there was another development, very interesting, in recent days. The Saudi foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal, let it be known that he had invited the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, to come to Saudi Arabia. And as you know, the Iranians have been looking for an invitation for a long time. Actually wrote something about this for VOA. To me, it suggests that the Saudis have accepted Assad is not going anywhere. There's probably going to be a nuclear deal with Iran, and we better start talking to them, because we have to recognize the reality that, you know, Iran is back. Yeah.
Yes, I think so. And I think, first of all, that should there be some sort of rapprochement real between the Saudis and the Iranians, there's a feeling, I don't know if it's justified or not, but there's a sense in the region it could have a positive impact on Iraq, primarily on Bahrain, which is the immediate neighborhood of Saudi Arabia, but also Syria. To what extent that may turn out to be true, previous experience tells us that the relations between the Iranians and the Saudis, there have been points of high tension, but there have been other points of less tension. That does not change the fact that these are two neighbors who do not politically like each other, and they will continue to vie for influence, not just in the immediate neighborhood of the Gulf, but obviously throughout the Islamic world. And I don't see how even inviting the Iranian foreign minister to come and visit Riyadh, I don't see how that's going to change that. But I think you're absolutely right. It seems that the Saudis, at least they have opened themselves up to the possibility that they may have to live with Bashar al-Assad for some time.
Yeah. And we should point out that the Iranians did help broker a ceasefire in Homs in Syria, which allowed a number of the rebel fighters to leave. They are a major player there, certainly, as well as in other parts of the region. I sort of look at them as sort of the two big boys on the block, you know, and without them, when they're clashing, the region definitely pays a price.
Two big elephants.
The two big elephants, right. If they can reach some understandings, it's not going to guarantee peace for sure, but it at least could contain some of the worst violence. A lot depends, though, Tom, on whether Iran can reach a nuclear agreement with the United States and the other permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. They met again in Vienna to start drafting a long-term agreement. There'd been a lot of optimism in the run-up to the meeting, and then all of a sudden everyone got very, very cautious, and we heard a lot of negative prognostication. One French person I was with actually said, oh, 25% chance they'll reach an agreement. We had been hearing 50-50 from Obama, and even better from some. What's your sense of whether they can actually get an agreement by July 20th, which is the deadline that they've set?
I guess I'm always a little skeptical about these sorts of things, but the body language had been more positive of late. It's possible, I don't know, but it's possible that the Iranians were pulling back a little bit, at least atmospherically, because of domestic political concerns. They cannot look like they're caving in to what Ayatollahs for a long, long time have referred to as the Great Satan of the United States and the West. And so I think the elements are there for a deal, but I'm still not sure, and you know, you're a far better analyst on this point than I. I'm still not sure how you were able to get the Iranians to agree to the sort of muscular, very robust, intensive inspection regime that they that the West is insisting upon, and they probably are gonna think is a little too much.
Yeah, I think actually the inspections are less the issue. The issue that seems to have emerged is the number of centrifuges. These are the machines that spin and enrich uranium, you know, that Iran will be allowed to have that will be commensurate with its quote-unquote practical needs. Right now, Iran has one civilian power reactor, which is fueled by the Russians, and They have a contract with the Russians that goes for another 9 years or so. And what the Iranians have been saying is that they would like to be able to make fuel for this reactor by the time that contract expires. And what the Americans are saying is, well, why can't you just keep getting fuel from Russia for this? It's very complicated to make the fuel for it. It's not just a matter of having the requisite number of centrifuges. So there have been numbers out there. My understanding, Abderrahim, is that the Iranians would accept a lower number of centrifuges of a better and more sophisticated nature and get rid of some of, they have these antiquated things that date back to the 60s, I think, called P1s, and you need tens of thousands of them to make a lot of fuel, but you only need a few thousand if you have the next generation. What's your sense of whether there are compromises that are available, and how much of this sort of downplaying is just to improve the atmospherics and for the final deal and show how, you know, how miraculous a deal actually was?
I think that, to me, it has to be seen within the context of the fact that much of what the Iranians do is real influence, and much of it is posturing. Real influence, I mean, this is a country that is under siege to all intents and purposes, and yet it wields influence in Iraq, it wields influence in Syria, in Bahrain, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in
Lebanon.
In Lebanon, in all sorts of places. But they have enormous economic difficulty. That's obviously very clear. And I think because they are under the gun of economic difficulty and sanctions, they really do not see anywhere else to go but to compromise and get some sort of, if not a deal, let's at least get some sort of détente, not just with the West, the United States, but also with their immediate Arab neighbors. Having said that, they've made it very clear where the ceiling for them is. They're saying, we're not trying to make a nuclear weapon. We're trying to develop a nuclear capability for peaceful purposes, and we're not going to compromise on that. My sense is that for the Iranians, for the Saudis, for the Americans, for everyone, these are problems that are so intractable, they will not get solved anytime soon. But I think the building up of trust to some level is happening that would allow the Iranians some sort of economic relief. It would allow the Saudis also some sort of political relief. Remember, the Saudis, they've lost one of their main pillars of support in their confrontations with the Iranians, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. They know that Field Marshal Sisi is very likely to become president. He's very staunchly pro-Saudi. But they know Egypt is debilitated. It's going to continue to be debilitated. So the Saudis don't have anywhere else to go either but to sort of allow some sort of détente with the Iranians.
Okay. We're going to turn to a topic now that we talked about last week, but it's frankly, and its potential consequences overwhelms everything else we've been talking about, and that is the consequences of climate change. Those of us living in this country, I'm sure in other countries, have observed rather extreme weather. The east coast of the United States is being inundated with precipitation, and the west coast of the United States has got forest fires of various sorts already, even though it's very early in the season because they have a historic drought. A new report, Tom, came out this week, and this one's from NASA and also from the University of California at Irvine, and they've been studying the ice at the poles of the world, and this is the West Antarctic ice sheet, which they say is melting, and that nothing will stop it from melting and releasing incredible quantities of water, raising the sea levels. Do you think that Americans, people around the world, are finally beginning to comprehend that steps must be taken to deal with emissions, with preparing for these sea level rises, these extremes of temperature and precipitation?
I think finally, belatedly, a lot of people are coming to that conclusion, some of them reluctantly, because it's hard to know exactly what you can do in the short term to deal with this. But you're right, Barbara, it's not just the bad weather, it's the extremes, and the extremes are getting more extreme. I would add to your list of floods and hurricanes and tsunamis and wildfires in what's called Tornado Alley in the Midwestern portion of the United States where I grew up. Tornadoes are more frequent and last longer. I mean, it used to be a couple of months growing up in Texas, mm-hmm. in North Texas, where you worried about tornadoes, and now you can worry about them for 3, 4, 5 months. And so I want to expand on something I said last week. 3 years ago, I was on a ship, which included a side trip to Antarctica. And we had a geographer on the ship who was lecturing on this, and he was asked what this was all about, and he was describing what now this report has described, that the Antarctic ice cap is melting and it is irreversible. And when you see that, you wonder about not only the east coast of the U.S. and other places, but places like the Seychelles and the Maldives, one of which is literally below sea level.
Abdurrahim, in the Middle East, there have been a lot of suggestions that some of the unrest actually had to do with climate, with the high price of food in a number of places and so on, with agricultural problems in Syria. That was some of the motivation for the uprising. So we've seen millions of Syrian refugees. We're probably going to see millions of climate refugees.
Yes, I mean, there have been a lot of warnings in the last few years about food shortages, rising cost of food throughout North Africa and the Middle East at a time when large parts of the region suffer from a shortage of rainfall and so on. Barbara, if you'll allow me to say this, I mean, mankind has always been motivated not just by science but also by interests. There will always be people who will look at the evidence, scientific evidence, and they'll go the other way because that's what their political interests dictate. And we started off talking about Erdogan. Natural disasters sometimes cause political disasters. In Turkey, as we've seen in the case of the mine, we've seen it in the case of Hurricane Katrina and what it did to the Bush administration. So it really is hard to think, especially in the poorer parts of the world, these climatic changes, it's hard to predict what they're actually going to do to those parts of the world in light of their shortage of means to deal with it.
Well, on that somber note, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.